AI right now. Well, again, Orwell would have been open-mouthed in astonishment as all of this proceeds, evoking little comment. But if we want to break convention and have a look at what we're doing, we can learn a lot about the war on terror and more generally about the effects of September 11th on policy.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th, at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Storefront was a thriving theater company in Portland, which closed in 1991. Triangle Theater is bringing back some of the burlesque acts and performances from this bygone era. Again, that's the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and it's just a minute after 11 o'clock. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can still become a member or renew by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Next up, we have Recovery Zone host Stephanie Potter presenting a recent talk by writer and visionary Susan Griffin on the shifts in Western culture needed for addressing climate change. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Last month, I had the privilege of listening to and recording a talk by Susan Griffin. Susan is a poet, essayist, playwright, and screenwriter. She was named by the Utney Reader as one of the 100 most important visionaries for the new millennium. She was here in Portland to address the complex issue of climate change through an exploration of the false divisions that separate us from the earth, each other, and even ourselves. This talk took place at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. Here's Susan Griffin.
I know that we share a sense of urgency right now about our earth and the environment, so that's not going to be the subject of my talk today. But really what I want to speak about is why other people not in this room with us tonight, other people who are not in some movement, who are not doing everything they possibly can, are not as alarmed as those of us here are. And I think it's important for us to study this, to understand it, because it can help us in our efforts to reach them and to build a bigger movement, and that's what we need. Of course, climate change poses the greatest threat to all our lives and to every living being on the planet that we know of today. So why is it as a society that we're not meeting the challenge? That's what I'm asking myself. And I came up with three causes or forms of denial. I'm sure that you can come up with a lot more of them. So I've simplified it to three, but it's entirely my own personal list and idiosyncratic. But what I did find when I came up with these three is that they are connected, that they are the kind of top of the iceberg of a whole system that lies underneath in the psyche, in the culture, that is less than conscious. And so part of my task tonight, I think, is to raise that system up to consciousness and talk about also ways that we might begin to shift that system and move it along. One of the forms of denial, and I'm sure you've all heard this, is people saying, well, they'll find a way to solve it. Who they is rather vague, but you know, they will solve it somehow. It's not entirely vague, and because what is meant by they is people in power, people running things. But then after that, it gets sort of vague. But the people running things will somehow solve the problem. But the reverse of that, and we don't usually think of these things as two sides of the same coin, but the reverse of that is just the other side of the coin, and that is they have all the power, so we can't do anything about it. So there you have that. That leads to despair. But the first, they will solve it somehow, is a very false and sort of frivolous hope. And that frivolous, false hope and despair are really part of the same psychological system. It's the same kind of response. And I call it a response that belongs to tyranny. We'll get more to that. Tyranny in the sense that we are looking to an authority either to solve something or not to solve something. The second category that you get many different responses, but basically the basic idea is they'll come up with a technological fix, or there will be a technological fix. We're working very hard. Now, some of these technological fixes are pretty good, and they will make a difference. Solar power, wind power, electric cars. I don't know, you know, why we need cars at all, but electric cars, you know, solar wristwatches, you know, whatever it is. You know, it's wonderful to have this technological innovation, and of course, if you really look at it, I mean, a lot of human endeavor is techne, it's craft. I mean, it's like a bowl is a technological. You know, at one point, humanity didn't have bowls, and then we came up with the woven shape of a basket and a clay bowl. So, you know, technological, you know, but this worship of technology, as that will always solve every problem, and I'm going to talk more about that. But the third category, talk more about each of these things, but the third category is one which purports to be spiritual, and it belongs to the kind of more fundamental versions of many of the world's quote-unquote great religions, and that is that real life is not material. This belongs particularly to the Abrahamic religions and particularly to the Christian tradition, that our real life is not on the earth, but it's transcendent. It's after we die, it's afterlife, and it's the spiritual life separated from our bodies, separated from our sensual and intuitive and emotional selves, and it'll live on even if the earth doesn't exist. It'll live on and maybe, you know, produce other great masterpieces after the earth is destroyed. So I'm going to start with this last form of denial because I think that it is it at one point was the bedrock of every other system of thought in the Western world, which is the dominant world right now. But also that I think it remains for most of us, myself included, a kind of psychological bedrock that I'm always having, at least myself, I'm always having to work with it, always having to remind myself that that's not what really I believe and it's not what I experience, but it's there all the time because I was raised that way. And that is this false dichotomy between spirit and matter. You find that even in progressive movements, and I'm always trying to correct people on this, but you know how irritating you can be when you're correcting people. But you know, I'm trying to say, you know, don't say materialism. Materialism is not the problem. Matter is a good thing. You know, consumerism maybe, or corporatism, but you know, materialism not because it's carrying on this tradition of somehow the devil existing in matter, in sensual temptation, in sexuality, in emotions, and the spirit existing in everything, you know, the spirit exists in higher math, you know, and in anything that's spiritual ideas separated from physical life. Now, the interesting thing is that science itself, we always think of science as being in conflict with religion, but in fact, science grew out of religion, and some of the first scientists in the medieval period, well, the first scientists, of course, were Greek, but there were in the Western, in the modern European tradition, some of the first scientists were monks. And in medieval, of course, in Christian theology, the soul and the spirit and matter were in conflict. And science actually preserved that dichotomy until the 20th century, because spirit, you know, in the Greek, it's breath, it's energy. What the original word root for spirit is what animates. And of course, that's the way it was used theologically too. It's the animating spirit. And that's supposed to be what's important and not lowly matter. Well, what science preserved that by calling spirit energy. And it looked at energy and matter as forever different, separate completely. And then along came a fellow we know as Einstein, and he came up with the formula E equals MC squared. And what is that saying? Well, we know it's, you know, matter by times the speed of light square or something like that, but what, and then that produces energy. But what it really means, cosmologically, even epistemologically, but definitely spiritually, is that that matter and energy aren't separate. That they are part of a whole, and that they partake of each other. And you go, and then, you know, one of the first things that higher energy physicists figured out was that energy actually has some mass, it has some weight, it can be weighed, it has a little bit of weight, and that at the heart of everything that exists, are the cells of our own bodies, the atoms, there's energy whirling around in it. So that separation is completely illusory. It's not true. It's not a real separation. But it persists in many different, more subtle forms. Some of them not so subtle. Some of them actually really hateful and terrible. One of the forms that separation has persisted in is misogyny. The idea that men are superior to women, that idea is linked to the idea that women are closer to the earth. And we do the cooking and cleaning and change the baby's diapers, and so it's obvious how much closer to the earth we are. And that makes us lesser beings. And also we're more emotional and more intuitive, and that makes us lesser beings. Well, look at that whole system and look how close it is to the racist profile of any person of color. Oh, they're more earthy, you know. They can sing and dance, you know. Well, they do, in fact, sing and dance, as do women, a lot better than some white men who are very divided. But we'll, you know, not all white men, though, thank God. Think of Tony Bennett, God. Okay, but... it's this, you know, it's actually, if you look at misogyny and racism and homophobia too, if you look at these, and by the way, prejudice against working people who work with their hands, so they work closely. Do you remember, was it George Murphy or Ronald Reagan? One of them said, oh, Mexicans are cut out for farm work because they're built closer to the earth. Remember which one of them said that? I think it was maybe George Murphy. I think he sort of ended his political career with that even then, but anyway. So to this, you know, I think I want to answer this with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King. Racism is total estrangement, and you know, I just want to repeat that. Racism is total estrangement. You can say that about misogyny too, homophobia. It's estrangement. It's estrangement. It's separating yourself away from life and others and meaning, and it separates not only our bodies but minds and spirit. We are separated, and this is the thing that's so beautiful. We are separated from ourselves. We are separated from ourselves. We are separated from our neighbors. We are separated from God. And then he goes on to say, the universe is so structured that things do not quite work out rightly if men, and you know, he was saying men, but he meant men and women, are not diligent in their concern for others. The self cannot be the self without other selves. We cannot be ourselves without other selves. And this is in fact true of our relationship with nature too. We cannot be ourselves without a relationship with nature. And it's an odd thing though to say a relationship with nature, because in a way, a relationship with nature is having a relationship with yourself, because we are all nature. We are all part of nature, and we are all nature. It's like saying, I don't live on the earth, I live in the earth. I am the earth, I am of the earth. But we, even in our grammar, you know, so we say live on the earth, you know, or relate to nature. It's very hard to break through these English patterns of speech that even in the way that we construct them grammatically separate us from our natural existence and look at ourselves as human beings as somehow above, you know, the rest of nature. So one of the forms that can be carried on in a secular way, you don't have to be religious to continue on with this kind of thinking. And one very subtle form of it is to think that intellectual life, artistic life, literary life, if you will go on without the earth. So we can take a refuge there in that. That has a kind of eternality. My words will live on. Shakespeare has a sonnet about, you know, lasting longer than marble. Sorry, Will, if the trees go, so go thee, you know. Anyway, I just wanted to say a few words to sort of take that one apart.
You're listening to Susan Griffin, who spoke last month at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland.
There's no way that we can even, as estranged a language as English and some parts of it has become, there's no way that we can speak any language without being indebted to, without a metaphor of nature. If you look at the etymology of almost any word, except maybe a, the, I haven't tried with those words, a, the, and, you know, those sort of utilitarian words. But if you have a word like truth, now that, you think, truth, that's an abstract concept, you know. Where's the natural metaphor there? We'll just look at it etymologically. Go back to the word root. And the word root for truth is a very straight tree. So, and you go through an etymology for almost any word and you'll find that somewhere in there is a material, an earthly metaphor. even our memory, how we talk about our feelings, our spiritual states, and now is the winter of our discontent. You know, she felt gloomy. He had a dry sense of humor. You are my sunshine. My ideas were flowing. What goes on in the shadows? She is under a cloud. We can't speak about our inner life without somehow evoking nature. Nor do we remember very well, apart from sensual experience, sensual knowledge, which is supposed to be way, you know, beneath kind of the lowly knowledge, way beneath higher mathematics and more elevated forms of thought. But sensuality is really the doorway to creativity and thought and memory. And I just want to read you this little section. You'll recognize it. And once I had recognized the taste of the crumb of Madeleine soaked in her decoction of lime flowers, which my aunt used to give me, although I did not yet know and must long postpone the discovery of why this memory made me so happy, immediately the old gray house upon the street where her room was rose up like the scenery of a theater to attach itself to the little pavilion opening onto the garden, which had been built out behind it for my parents, the isolated panel which until that moment had been all that I could see, and with this, when with the house, the town, from morning to night, and in all weathers, the square where I was sent before luncheon, the trees along which I used to run errands, the country roads we took when it was fine. Of course, I'm quoting from Swan's Way, Proust's Swan's Way. So that sense in which even our own very personal memories are, in fact, integrated with sensual experience and all of the earthly forms around us. Even Einstein, by the way, who broke apart that separation between matter and energy, he used metaphors. He didn't only use math. He used metaphors to think through relativity. He used the metaphor of an elevator and the metaphor of trains. So these physical experiences were the basis for him to think these things through. By the way, what did we do with E equals MC squared? Did we change our cosmology? Did we change our way of thinking? Did we say, oh, let's welcome matter into, you know, let's understand that all matter contains spirit? No such thing, no. We built nuclear weapons, is what we did. So I'm not going to go into it, but deconstruction in its own strange way, Derrida's thought that was so fashionable for a while, also recognizes how meaning cannot exist in isolation. The central understanding that drives all of deconstruction is that no single word means anything out of the context. It needs other words to define it. Out of context, it means nothing at all. Now, some people, I don't think Derrida himself, but a lot of American scholars, for a while interpreted that as a kind of nihilism, that everything is empty of meaning. But I think really what Derrida meant to be conveying was that everything is connected. The second form of denial we have is that somehow technology will save us, and I want to look more deeply at that. We've had this many times in the modern world, and the one that I'm going to refer to right now is the steam engine. Are many of you familiar with the role the steam engine played in the 19th century? It really ushered in the Industrial Revolution. It made the Industrial Revolution possible. The steam engine was not only for trains, but for all kinds of other equipment that allowed for industrialization, mechanization of our lives. And there was a kind of sense in which it reinvigorated the modern mind, because once in the 19th century, theology had sort of, quote unquote, lost its steam. Something was needed again to enliven the culture. And oddly enough, this new technology fit the bill. Because you see, what we'd done was the secular world, even more than the religious world, the secular world of science, had begun to picture the world as something that matter as dead, basically. If it doesn't have a spirit, it's kind of dead. You know, so then how can you get excited about that? It's like making love to a corpse, you know. It doesn't inspire erotic loving energy, you know. So we needed a kind of mechanical Viagra, is the way I look at it. And that was the steam engine. And I'm being funny here, but when you read the text, you see that I'm not exaggerating, hardly at all. There's a French man who introduced the steam engine into French society, wrote these words about it. Long ribbons of iron along which rush, rapid as thought, those fordable machines which seem to eat up space with a spontaneous impatience and which seem almost alive in their breathing and their movement. One of the claims for the steam train and the steam engines in general was that they would erase labor, and human beings wouldn't have to work anymore, and we'd all be liberated, and there would be social equality. Well, we know that that's not at all what happened with the Industrial Revolution, and the only thing that created a modicum of equality eventually was the union movement, not steam engines. The other thing that occurred during the same period was this advance into, we called it an advance, in the United States, westward, the westward expansion. And during this time, the steam train played a very big role because more people could go west once there were these rails built. A sort of tragic side chapter of this was that when Lewis and Clark pushed up the Missouri River, this was in 1804, there were 60 million bisons. 60 million bisons. And by 1902, there were 23 or 24 bison left in the world. Now, you probably know that they're being revived now in various programs. But what is it that decimated them? Well, it became a kind of a sport to kill them. And one of the advertised pleasures of taking a steam train west was that the train would stop at various places and allow the men who were on the train to get off and shoot buffalo with their rifles. There's a photograph that I've seen where it's as high as a skyscraper and it's bison skulls. So speed became a kind of object of adulation. The steam train could reach great speed compared to, you know, horses. And so speed itself became a sort of object of adulation. And I don't know if you know the work of Marinetti, the Italian futurist poet, but he wrote, "Velocity has finally given human life one of the attributes of divinity, the straight line." He said, "Slowness, analysis of all forms of stagnant prudence, passive and pacifist," and so he associated being a pacifist with being passive and slowness, and they all belong together. "And velocity was the synthesis of all forms of courage and action, aggressive and martial." And Marinetti aligned himself with Mussolini and the Fascist Party. He did repudiate Mussolini after Mussolini became aligned with the Nazis and the Holocaust. But in the meantime, 60 million dead, 60 million people died in World War II. And this was from this sort of, you know, glorification of speed. And the object of adulation above any other was the airplane, because it could go faster than anything else. Now, we haven't lost this adulation of speed. After 60 million dead, after decimating the bison herds, after, you know, creating terrible poverty, terrible social inequality, which of course we're facing again now with the 1% and the 99%, we still are adulating speed. And so I think what we have now is a kind of form of electronic Viagra, and that is the computer is the form we're all in love with. Now, I have an iPad right up here that I use, and I have my iPhone and my this and that. I've got all my things. But but it does become a little bit strange when you see these kids lined around, you know, 2 and 3 blocks. And they're not excited about books. They're not excited about plays and paintings. And they're not getting together and forming communities and saying, "Let's save the earth." You know, they're lined up for these things. And I think, again, it's drawn this kind of strange erotic energy to it because we're still seeing the world around us as dead. And so here these objects are reflecting some kind of life. There was an ad that I saw recently on the television this guy gets more speed on his internet connection. And the man in the ad declares, I never felt more alive. You know, as he has this really quick, you know, connection. It's, oh my God, you know, so, but one of the, what is it underneath that? It's kind of this great sexy thing with all these speedy, you know, computer connections, but what is that speed really serving in the world? What is it really doing? Well, what it was most useful for and still is most useful for is doing trades on Wall Street. Computers are basically still big calculators, and they can do very complicated calculations very quickly, which allows investors to move very quickly and then make more money. So they accumulate big data, and whoever accumulates that big data has a chance to accumulate big money. Let me pause here for a moment and talk to you about a book that I'm reading now by Robin Wall Kimmerer. She is a Potawatomi and a botanist combined. So she combines the Native American cosmology, which does not separate spirit and matter, with science. And she's written two very wonderful books. I'm reading one right now called Gathering Moss, and she's studying moss. And she writes there that their way of being in the world cannot be told by data alone. There is so much that cannot be understood by data, and that's a whole drift in our culture right now that I find is very, very, very serious. Even though there's great data that we need, I don't know if you've seen James Balog's film about ice, and he's accumulated moving pictures of and data, and there's all this data being accumulated about the loss of, you know, glaciers and glacier melt, and the NASA data about climate warming, and this is all terribly, terribly important. So I'm not attacking science here, but this emphasis on data above anything else, any other kind of knowing. And even in science, there are ways of knowing that scientists employ that are not purely, can't be reduced to data. For instance, I don't know if you know the work of Barbara McClintock. She's now died, but she won the Nobel Prize. And she won the Nobel Prize by understanding somehow how one piece of DNA, gene, I guess, leaps from one DNA strand. Anybody here a botanist? Anyway, in corn. And she was able eventually, she studied Tibetan Buddhism, and she was able, and she learned a way of seeing and a way of looking, and she was able to look at a kernel of corn, a stalk of corn, and understand certain things about genetics just from looking with her naked eye. And then looking in a regular microscope, not at an electronic microscope, and be able to discuss these kind of things that you, you know, how did she know this? Well, this is this way of seeing it. It's what Robin Wall Kimmerer calls a kind of intimacy.
You're tuned to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland and listening to playwright and poet Susan Griffin, who spoke last month at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland.
Intimacy, relationship, through intimacy and relationship, that's a way of knowing. It's a very profound way of knowing. And it's something that we're erasing in our culture right now. So that, for instance, big data is being used, is being presented as the problem solver for everything. I'm going to quote Emma Uprichard from the University of Warwick. She's a professor of sociology, and she writes, big data is being presented as the future problem solver for all things, from breast cancer to low-cost governance, from better security to predictive systems, from smart cities and better traffic and water systems to an end to urban squalor. Again, end to urban squalor. We're going to create social equality from big data now, you see. But who is it in the meantime who's making all the money? It's the big investors and the big CEOs in Google and every other. You know, they've ended their own urban squalor. It promises cleaner, more sustainable, renewable energy, better banking, better governance, better education for all, better efficient, faster, more cost-effective, everything. If we thought utopian authors were full of hope for better futures, The public discourse of big data is akin to a future fairy godmother with a magic wand, and believe me, I'm not against fairy godmothers, except, you know, fairy godmother with a magic wand, granting wishes to help solve some of the world's most wicked problems. So this, and if you look at reducing, it's a reduction. Numbers are reduced. Numbers, after all, by the way, are metaphors. They are not reality. They are metaphors. They're metaphors, but you don't get the flavor, the touch, the smell, the sound. They're the most abstract thing that you can imagine. And now we are in a society that worships numbers. So it's being used in education, for instance. Our kids are being tested and tested and tested. I don't know if any of you have grandkids or children in the school system and how often they're being tested and how they hate these tests. And then what do they do with the tests? The school where the kids are doing well get rewarded, and where the kids aren't doing well, they get money withheld. Well, that's crazy. That's where they need the money, you know. So, but also, what are they testing? They're testing the ability to take tests, excuse me, but that's what they're testing. And then the teachers are teaching to get their children to pass the tests so that they can meet these standards, so that they get the money. So when it comes all the way around, even somebody in education is getting caught in a kind of recycling of monetization. It's all monetization. Let's reduce everything again to numbers or dollars. Cornel West says that education has become market-driven schooling, and he's right. Emotional intelligence, the relationship between students and their teachers, the wisdom of the arts, including dance, literature, music, are all left out of the equations used to calculate the success of education. So that U.S. Senator Ron Wyden describes the plan to build a system that can tell prospective students how much they are likely to earn with a degree from a particular program. Not what's in your heart, what fascinates you, what you love, what you connect to, but, you know, what are you going to earn at the end of this? So that we're crafting this value system that is very alienating. It's also being used in psychology. I won't go into that, except that one of the things that is happening now in psychology is that being driven by big data is aligning it with big pharma, so that you have a certain amount of data, and this is not just an opinion of mine. Everybody I know who's in psychology is talking about it. That with the data, then that can justify the use of drugs on people and all these quantitative tests that are done. And meanwhile, what's happening in the soul, any kind of transformation in the soul, all the wonderful things that my friend James Hillman was talking about when he was with us, you know. He talked about suicide. His understanding of suicide as being the desire actually to grow and to kill an old self. You know, Ronnie Lang, understanding the politics of experience and how we're living, way back in the 60s, writing about how we're living in a culture that crushes and destroys human experience. You know, and these kids now, and I know because I taught for a while in an institute of psychology, are not being taught these ideas. They're not discussing them. All they're bent on is doing these studies with numbers that show this is effective and that's effective and this, we do short-term therapy on this and we've gotten these good results. And they're all done with these sort of quantitative, you know, well, how many times did you wake up and you felt good, you know? Anybody here on Medicare? Yeah, me too, okay. Have you had any kind of, treatment where you have to go in and there are these little kind of faces and you have to rate how much pain you had? You know, I've got some, you know, and they're ridiculous. They're ridiculous and nobody takes them seriously. And, you know, you're supposed to circle, you know, and this is somewhere going to be computed up and it's all going to be shown. And look here, these treatments were effective because, see, 28,000 people circled this frowning face, and you know, you say, I mean, you know, and this is healing in our day and age. You know, this is what healing is being reduced to. I want to go back to Einstein just briefly before I move on to the third form of denial, and that is Einstein's wonderful quote from him: "Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. The third form of denial, which was, you know, I began talking about, is this idea that authority knows best. They'll save the day, or they have all the power, so we can't do anything anyway. Now, the real power now resides with corporations and not government. We know that. Corporations hold more power than the government at this point. But what does that do? That reinforces the idea that they have more power. It doesn't make us feel more free. It reinforces it because 9 out of 10 of most of America is employed by a corporation. I'm not talking about somebody who's on a board of directors or is a CEO. Could be a janitor in a building for an insurance company, but you're employed by that corporation. You work as a clerk in Walmart. You're employed by a corporation. So when the Walmart people went on strike, they said, please keep shopping at Walmart. We depend on this corporation for our livelihood. So it's the now the employer, not nature. You see, the people, the impulse is not nature. Nature doesn't keep me alive. Walmart keeps me alive. You know, it sounds like it's that we're just talking about an idea here, but it's a very fundamental physical reaction. And I understand it. I've just been through 5 years, as most writers. We're not supposed to say this publicly because we think that it might, you know, hurt our careers monetarily. But we've had a very hard time of it. The publishers have decided not to give advances of any size anymore. So we've had a terrible time keeping alive. And it's hard to realize that I'm alive because I'm breathing, because I'm on a green planet, because of gravity as we're whirling through space, because of the wonderful cooperation and collaboration with everything alive on the earth, including water and stone and sky and clouds. And, you know, that's why I'm alive. I'm not alive because I've managed to sell an article to some sort of magazine. The magazine is not keeping me alive, you know, but this is what, but it gets into us in a very deep way that our lives depend on the power of various authorities, mainly at this point corporations. The irony is that to avoid regulation, the corporate interests advertise the virtue of individual freedom, but at the same time they're merging into greater and greater conglomerates. And so they understand that this sort of conglomerate power, or they believe anyway that it makes them more efficient, but at the same time they themselves as conglomerates are not recognizing that they belong to a much larger conglomerate than that. They belong to the whole planet, and the whole planet works together. And they themselves are not independent of this conglomerate. None of us are. So the despair we feel is really an expression of the belief that we are powerless, and it's the underside of tyranny. It's tyranny internalized. So this is something that is very, very important to work with. And one of the ways that tyranny is able to continue is that in a system where we deny intuitive intuition, emotional intelligence, sensual knowledge, we are denying our own ability to understand, to perceive an injustice, to speak out about it, to describe it. When we lose these fundamental properties, we give them up because Big Data really knows. It's like Big Daddy, Big Data, not a lot of difference, you know. Hannah Arendt in Origins of Totalitarianism talks about a phenomenon that was really telling in World War II in Germany. When the Allies were bombing German cities, and there were many German cities, and you've seen the photographs, I'm sure, of post-World War II, and the cities reduced to rubble. And Goebbels, who was head of propaganda, got on the radio and said, the Allies are not making any progress at all in bombing raids. They're not able to harm us at all. And people chose to believe Goebbels than what they saw with their, and what they experienced. They couldn't get food. They sometimes got trapped in blocks. They couldn't get through the rubble. They couldn't get drinking water. But they believed Goebbels rather than to believe their own direct experience. So reclaiming our own ability to, which is, by the way, what science, this one of the spirits of science in the beginning was about. You know, it was about de-tyrannizing knowledge. It isn't the church fathers who can tell us what is true. We can look at experience, and we can look at nature, we can look at ourselves and experiment and ask questions and observe and find out the truth in that way. Well, we're losing that now. What we've done, what we're doing in this, what's happening to us in this culture, one of the side effects of our destruction of nature is that we're becoming atomized and isolated ourselves. That the connection to others depends on, I believe, a connection to nature. That that the most fundamental connection is our relationship to nature. And I want to talk for a while and end with some discussion of how nature teaches us connection. That in nature, we experience connection. And I'm including in nature, by the way, the experience we all have as infants of our mother's bodies. That's our first experience of nature. In 1923, the philosopher Martin Buber published a famous book. I think you probably have all read it, I and Thou. And I wonder if you've looked at it again. This is beautiful, beautiful paragraph. I contemplate a tree. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can overcome its uniqueness and form so rigorously that I recognize it only as an expression of the law. I can dissolve it into a number. But it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it.
This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, and you're listening to a talk given by playwright and poet Susan Griffin last month at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland.
Now, Robin Wall Kimmerer, Potawatomi botanist, took it upon herself. She's, mixed background, and one of her grandfathers was Potawatomi, but he was browbeaten out of his culture when he was sent to a boarding school, and you probably, most of you know that history of what happened to so many indigenous people all over the world. And so she never learned any Potawatomi. She didn't know the language. And at a certain point when she was going to meetings of councils, native councils, there was one of the few living speakers of Potawatomi stood up and made a plea. He said, this language is going to disappear. There's only, a handful of us now who can speak it, and if you can take it upon yourselves. And so she did, and she started to learn the language, and she was about ready to throw her hands up because she was just trying to find the word for bay, bay. What is the Potawatomi word for bay? Meaning, bay, like you have right here in Portland. And all she could find was something called being a bay. And she was really annoyed with it. Oh my God, what is this bay as a thing? Being a bay. Because in Potawatomi, a bay is alive. And so it's a verb. It's not a noun. See, and it's being a stone. A stone is alive. So it's a tree is not a noun. It's a being a tree. The intelligence that exists outside human existence is very powerful, and I think most of us as children felt that intuitively. We were told to, grow out of it, don't be silly, don't talk to the tree, don't talk to your dog, you know. Dog doesn't speak English, you know. Some of them do, actually, you know, we know that. But so, in fact, bit by bit, science now is beginning to understand how much intelligence there is in the universe around us, and many different forms of intelligence. For instance, Suzanne Simard, who's a forest ecologist at the University of British Columbia, have made the discovery that trees and plants communicate and interact with each other. So when you're in a forest and there's one tree there, it's not really alone. It's communicating with all these other trees, and it's actually sharing carbon. And we've always, well, the one feature that I always heard, you know, was, you know, the bigger trees get more sunlight, and so they, you know, the bigger guys win out, which is what we're told over and over again with Darwinian evolution. It's not quite true, because Darwin also had the principle of diversity, and a whole system with more diversity survives better. So it's not just the biggest. If there's only the biggest, we've got the dinosaurs and we're in trouble. It's, you know, it's the cooperation and it's and difference and variety. And so what happens is not only even among the same species in a forest, but different species, they share carbon. And one of the ways they do this is through fungus. The fungus will wrap its way around a root of a tree. And then there'll be a mother tree, the big tree. I love that she calls it a mother tree. I don't know what the trees call it. They probably don't call it a mother tree, but this large tree that's in charge of everything, not in terms of being the boss, but it makes sure that there's a division that is helpful to everybody. So this tree has more CO2 than anybody else and sends it out and tries to find the neediest, you know, to get this, you know. And this is, so when you're in a forest, you're in this community of cooperation, collaboration, and sharing. Pretty amazing, huh? So different than the way we've been raised. A Native American good friend of mine called Melissa Nelson, she's been the director for years of Cultural Conservancy, and she's on Anishinaabe, and she talks about how the Anishinaabe worship water. Water, or ni'ibi, is a primary sacred element in life, I'm quoting her, cherished as an essential relative, ancestor, teacher. So if we have this drought, this water crisis in California, for instance, it's not just that we can't water, you know, we can't plant the same kind of gardens and we have to move to succulents, you know, or the agriculture is going to have problems and all our food prices are going to, and this is all bad enough, but it's that our relative is suffering. Our cherished relative and a great spirit, a great guide to us all, water, is suffering. So this is a very important shift. And and another way of seeing that is part of indigenous culture is reciprocity. And reciprocity we think of in, you know, sort of late capitalism, we think of reciprocity, well, I have 5 marbles that are red and you have 5 that are blue and I like the blue better, maybe you like the red, so let's exchange our marbles, you know, or I'll give you 2 red and you give me 3, you know, that's not reciprocity. Reciprocity is a much deeper concept. So what is reciprocity? I'm quoting now from Sherry Weber Nicholson. It is far more than an exchange between beings who are essentially external to another. Let us rather think of reciprocity as mutual recognition and influence that involve not only individual separateness, but also a relating based on an embodiment in which psyche and senses, internal and external worlds, are engaged. And then I love the example she uses for this. Think of the infant. The baby's self is formed through a passionate interchange with the mother's body and psyche. This is just elemental, what we now know as, you know the psychological point of view is that, you know, the child forms the self through the mother, and the mother is not only physically nourishing the child with mother's milk, but also helping give the child a self. That's a reciprocity. But it's only possible, it only can happen when the mother perceives the baby. The baby learns to perceive the mother, but this only happens when the mother perceives the baby. So that's this, you know, this mutuality of perception, this mutuality of intelligence and transformation and soul. By the way, I'm not going to go into it because I don't have time, but I just want to do this one thing. Speaking of the sacredness of water, where is it? Oh, I don't have it. Oh, yes, I do have it. I forgot. I copied it out here. Okay. Speaking of the sacredness of water, I'm trying to teach myself about climate. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult subject. And I'm writing a book that's not very well written, and so it's even harder. But I think I understand this. In any case, the basic point is there. I do get the basic point. The intensification of glaciation, which happened about 500,000 years after the start of the Great Ice Ages, created a strong circulation of ocean, east-west ocean currents called the Walker Circulation. And it created a strong rainfall in the tropics, leading to lakes in the East African Rift. And this led to the evolution of Homo erectus. So when you think of, you know, who am I? You know, how was I born? You can say, well, I was born because of glaciation. You know, or you can also say, in Robin Wall Kimmerer's book called Gathering Moss, about mosses. Mosses were the first plants to leave water. And they grow along the bank of water. And mosses, because they had left water, they no longer could plant their eggs in water and have the sperm go to the egg in the water. They had to protect the egg because it was too dry. So the mammalian construct that we were born out of, that the egg is held in the mother's womb, began with mosses. So you can say, who am I? Well, my great 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 ancestor was a moss, you know. So and of course that's what the Anishinaabeg say, you know, that water is extremely important and revered by the Anishinaabeg. This is quoting from Melissa Nelson again, from her essay, Hydro Mythologies. For its role in archaeological survival and social cohesion, but also for our very identity and cosmology. Nisbi Manitus, which means water spirits, are essential for an understanding of metaphysical realms, the fluidity of consciousness, and the ambivalence of power. And by the ambivalence of power, she is talking about the water spirit. Does the water spirit want humanity to live or die? You know, or does the water spirit wish us well or not wish us well? Or is the water spirit trying to wake us up, you know, with, for instance, a typhoon or a terrible tsunami? So we need to tell ourselves a new story. That's what I'm going to end with. I'm going to actually end with a short poem from a Senegalese poet, but I want to, with my words, I want to end with, we really need to tell a new story, that concerning the survival of both our bodies and our souls, we're dependent on others. Other human beings, animals, plants, bodies of water, currents of air, formations of clouds. We need stories that recognize, name, and name our kinship with the earth so we can see the way that Melissa Nelson, Robin Kimmerer, and by the way, the mother trees see in the forest, or the mosses see. We need to see this, and I think that it's only until we make this really huge shift. It's a very challenging shift. I was telling Marilyn the other day when I flew in, saying, you know, it's very challenging to the human ego, but I think it's important in all of this to understand that if we don't meet the challenge of climate change, it's not the Earth that will be destroyed, it's us. I mean, us and life as it is now around us. But the Earth will go on, and the different forms of life will be created. It's just we who are going. It's very hard for us to get that. But that, and the negative side is we need to be able to get that. But we also need to get, we need to understand how dependent we are. And that is, runs so against the current of modern day thinking and our modern ethos. But we really do need to get this in our bones, how deeply dependent we are on each other and how others are dependent on us, how we are responsible for creation and creation is responsible for us. And one way to look at that is that we are surrounded by love. And I'm going to read you a poem that says that too, by the Senegalese poet Tierno Seydou Sall, Song of the Stars. Having become choreographers, the stars orchestrate in their white robes tapestries of dreams, pain, and joy, pulsations of love in the heart of life.
You've just been listening to a talk by poet, playwright, and visionary Susan Griffin that was recorded in April at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. This is the Recovery Zone on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. Thanks for listening.
KBOO is proud to partner with Hopworks Urban Brewery for their Community Tap program. Every month, Hopworks features a local nonprofit organization, and May's Community Tap is your community radio, KBOO. Hopworks is located at 2944 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. For more information,